You are listening to the In Context podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. Today we have a special guest. We have Joel Morris. He is an author of the books Revolutionary God and Big Hearted, and he's also the executive director of Union School of Theology. So good morning, Joel, and welcome to the In Context podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Good chat to you this morning. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the time. I know you're a busy man. Executive director sounds like an important title, and Union School of Theology sounds like a fantastic place. So what is Union, and what does your role involve?
Yeah, good question. So Union is really... we kind of rebooted an old sort of traditional Welsh seminary, and we wanted to reform it into something that was really useful for the church, to serve the church, to grow, to see, you know, great growth, revival kind of growth. And we wanted to be strategic, wanted to be really serving the needs of the local churches. How do we fuel that growth in the church? And so obviously leadership development, growing leaders, raising up leaders is a big part of it with the school of theology. But we wanted to make that more accessible. So what is Union? Union is kind of an ecosystem, really. Now we've got Union Publishing coming through. That's books, free resources. And that really draws people in to good theology. It draws people into the school. We've got Union Mission, which is at the sort of the other end of things, where we try to support our students and alumni in planting and growing churches. So we've raised a lot of money to fuel those church plants, to support those plants from our partners, our donors. And then Union Research is a sort of high level, sort of scholarly academic thinking, and encouraging people to write and encouraging people to research and being a catalyst in that area. So it's really seeking to develop a whole ecosystem around growing the church across Europe, around the world, with great reformed theology, seeking to see the church reformed and strengthened and become healthy. So that's really what Union is all about. That's what makes us tick. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning. And in terms of what I do at Union, I support Michael Reeves. I do the things that he shouldn't be doing, business side of things, fundraising, marketing, that sort of, all those sorts of things that we just don't want Michael Reeves getting tied up with, releasing him to go and write and preach and teach and be do what he's good at doing.
So you keep the beast alive, basically.
I keep feeding the beast.
Oh, well, you're at a Bible college, you've got a busy job, you've been a missionary. I'm a bit of a stalker, so I've done my research.
Oh my goodness.
And found out that you've been a missionary, you've worked in secular workplaces, in aerospace and nuclear science. You could have wrote about so many things. You could have wrote about being a missionary, something more theological or systematic, or you could have even looked at creationism, all kinds of things. Your background opens you up to talk about so many specific aspects of theology, yet you've chosen to write two books, both of them pretty general, which speak to all of us, regardless of whether we're in ministry full-time or whether we're just called to ministry in secular employment. The first one being Revolutionary God, and the second one being Big Hearted. So why did you speak about these two specific things? What caused you to take time from your busy life to write on these two areas?
Yeah, thanks, man. Well, with the first book, it's really the first one I've ever written, and for me it was getting out of my brain all of the ideas that I had, all of the sort of just the thoughts and the things that I've been thinking about over the years. That comes from theology, comes from working with Michael Reeves. I write because I enjoy it. I actually do it on the weekends or in the evenings because it's not my job, my day-to-day job. It's something that feeds my soul and relaxes me. And so I do it purely for selfish reasons because I enjoy it, and I'm really benefiting from it. I'm not seeking to, it's not part of what I do for Union as such, not that I see. But it can help and feed into Union as well. But the fact that I can get it published is a bonus, really. I just find myself writing, and Mike's encouraged me as well. And I'm in that sort of environment with other writers, so it's a kind of catalytic thing, which is great and encouraging. But I was as surprised as anybody to see, to sort of get into writing. Being a dull boy from the valleys, English wasn't my, wasn't my strength in school. I was more into sciences and stuff. So, it's thrilling. And so the first book is really getting those ideas off my brain. Revolutionary God. There's a few things going on. When we formed Union, when Mike came in and we started working together, it felt like a revolution. It felt like it was that sort of culture and that sort of excitement that we're revolutionizing, what it means to do a school of theology, what it means to do ministry, very much on the sort of in the spirit of the reformers. That's really strong with Mike. And I don't know if you've met Mike or if you've chatted with him. But that comes, he lives it out, lives out that theology, how we approach ministry. Union is really just, it's reformed, reforming, and we keep wanting to reforming it. We don't want it to fossilize. And so it's a connection of that sort of Reformation theology with the fact that we're always meant to be reforming the church, and being vibrant and fresh and creative, and so that, yes, I want to do something around that sort of caught the essence and the culture internally at Union, that sort of revolutionary kind of heart, connected with theology, but also I wanted to do a book that made our theology accessible to people in my church, and I just wanted to use different words to communicate, the orthodox truths, doctrines of the Reformation. I just knew that if I'm starting to use those words that people are used to, that they would just switch off or they wouldn't pick it up. So it was, how do I write a book that that doesn't put people in my church off, even though they actually love Reformed theology? That my pastor Tom Clewer, preaches with, he's Reformed and he preaches in that way, and so people love it, people like it. It's the kind of the categories and the words that I thought is off-putting. So I wanted to communicate it in a way that people would pick it up, and especially people in my church, because I thought, if you get it, if you really get into this, it's just the Bible. It's just truth. You love it and you grow and yeah. So that was the driver for the first book. I wanted to pick up on different experiences in my life as well, and just what I've observed in the church in the UK, and kind of reflect on that, stuff around radical union. And not sort of being, lone wolves, but reforming the church, drawing together to do that, and seeking to work with others that share your convictions and your hearts, just sort of the last sort of 20 years or so, just seeing a lot of fragmentation and tribalism, politics, and seeking to kind of respond against that, really, in a helpful way, I hope.
And it was refreshing for me to see both the books. The first one, what I took out of it, Revolutionary God, was being risk takers for God. The second one, Big Hearted, again, that's in the title, really quite obvious, about generosity, giving things away. And I think when I was first saved, I was saved into, wasn't quite wealth, health and prosperity, but it wasn't far away. The main preaching was focused on comfort. Mm. A lot of the books that we see out and talks about the comfort of God. I think even you quote Gentle and Lowly, and it just, a lot of the things we read is for our personal benefit about how much God gives to us. But very few books that you read talk about taking risks, being willing to die and to give up comfort and to serve God. So I found the Revolutionary God in particularly inspiring, encouraging and convicting. And I just think, why focus on risk and generosity? What brought you to that point? Because writing a book on risk is probably risky itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess they're really a kind of reflection of myself and what I'm you know, journeying through at the time. Mm-hmm. Taking risks is part of the life of ministry and certainly at Union, you know, massive risks and gambles, stepping out in faith, really through difficulty, through suffering and struggle, and being willing to, you know, to stretch out and and take that, yeah, take the step of faith regularly and not be comfortable. God didn't really allow us to be comfortable, I guess. And big hearted, that was really a response to helping our donors, helping our supporters. I found myself in situations with friends. I consider them friends, who some of them are donors, who even in their homes, I'd be pastoring them and discipling them, which is wonderful to be able to do that. But I realized that there was a lack of understanding around the theology of generosity, why we should give. It's all very pragmatic. In the generosity movement, you see resources, good resources, a lot of biblical stuff. Obviously, it's right to give, but I really wanted to drill down into the why and really get to the heart of it. I didn't feel compelled, even myself, by these arguments and by what was being taught and spoken about. So that's really why I wrote it. I felt a heart for our supporters to give them that good theology, to give them stuff that we've really lost from the culture, from our culture in church in the West. Being willing to risk and being willing to suffer. Just looking back at those great stories with you know, Muller and lots of gospel patrons of their day in Victorian times and in the 1700s, just how God raised up great men to lead the church, but also great patrons to support those efforts. Even recently, I discovered in Wales, both my grandfathers were coal miners in the Welsh Valleys in South Wales. So that's the kind of family I come from. And just discovering that some of the guys who owned a lot of the mines in Wales, in South Wales, were Christians. This one guy, I think it's the Cawley family, living in this big mansion in Dufferin House, Dufferin Gardens, where I go, my family, it's a National Trust property now. I had no idea this guy fueled the forward movement to plant hundreds of churches, but he cared, had a heart for his workers, his and their families, and he cared for them, and he wanted to build churches, and so he partnered with people like Frank and Seth Joshua, and they they built a lot of churches. So that's something you don't get to, you know, don't get heard about. That's in Geraint Fielder's book, Grace, Grit, and Gumption. Great book. So yeah, that really stirred my heart to see the potential for ministry, for church growth. If we can connect, if we can get donors, if we can get business people thinking in this way, having this theology, what could that do for the growth of the church around the world? What could that do to unleash and open even greater resources and potential? Yeah, that's really what's troubling at the moment for me, is there's such a need, there's such huge need, and God is raising up great people, God is working his church, and so if I can do something to give people the right theology. And like you said, I mean, I really want to draw a line between Trinitarian Reformed theology driving practice, driving through to heart and practice and outworking. And again, there wasn't a connection between this God who is overflowing and cheerfully giving of himself, giving his son Christ, pouring out himself on the cross for us, and drawing a line to we should be like God, we should be godly, and we should be cheerfully generous and overflowing because he's overflowing. We receive from him, we receive his love, we love him, so we can love others. And I wanted to draw that and make that really the kind of the heart of the book in terms of the theology of the why. And there's a bit of practice in there as well, trying to address different contexts in the UK, in America, wanting to serve our people, but also wanting to give a book to pastors to give to the congregations to shepherd their hearts. I know pastors do struggle to tackle these sorts of issues and to teach them in their churches. So if I could give a pastor a book that could do that for them, maybe they could go through it. Then again, that's a win, isn't it?
Yeah, and these books, I did a review of the first book, and I said what you're saying isn't actually revolutionary.
No.
You should all know. And what you're saying in the second book isn't revolutionary. So what is wrong with the Western church? Because to take risks is took for granted in China, in Iran, Christians in northern Nigeria being killed on a regular basis. So across the globe, Christians understand that risk-taking and generosity is vital. We see the early church thrived on risk-taking and generosity. Throughout the Bible, every main character took risks. including our Saviour, and again, how more generous can you be, which you point out, than give your life for others? So what is wrong? Is it the preaching? Is it the teaching? What has caused this apathy within the church in the UK towards both risk-taking and generosity that we need to be reminded, that we need to have it explained? When did this problem start, and how have we got to this place?
Yeah, I think it's really that we've grown comfortable and we've stopped. You know, the church had stopped being countercultural. And when I went with OM on mission on the ships, I struggled when I came back. I really struggled to integrate back into society because you've been exposed to real poverty, to real suffering, to not a comfortable existence, not a comfortable life, and you've lived that yourself. Really, you've not been able to just go down the shops and buy a chocolate bar, and you don't, you don't have the comfort that you're used to, and so. Coming back to this sort of, we're so wealthy, we're so comfortable. was hard to readjust. I did obviously, and then forgot about it, but which isn't good. But it's just so easy, isn't it, that everything is so easy and it's comfortable, and we take our freedom for granted. And so I think it's suffering is an important part of the church growing, thriving, and but when we're comfortable, we don't want to suffer. We don't want to take risks. We become risk averse, and so we've got to be reminded by brothers and sisters from other countries that know the blessing and know the real joy of suffering, but of leaning on God, leaning on Christ, and depending on Him, and being willing to give everything up for Him, and being willing to. And I think as well, we buy into the lie, isn't it? I guess during the 70s and 80s and the 90s, it's you buy into the lie. We're a developed country. We're wealthy. The church is doing this, and we just subconsciously integrate that sort of worldly economy or economics into our Christianity without even realizing it. I was going through John Edwards' book, his works, and he tackles a section on stewardship, and it's such a revolutionary, and again, it's so orthodox, but it's such a revolutionary worldview of it's almost like God's economy. This is how God works, and that we are merely stewards of what we're given and what we think we earn. We think that we own. We buy into the lie that I own this. I own this stuff. I own this money. I made it. But actually, you're a steward, and it's what the decision that you're going to make is what do I want to keep. It shouldn't be what I should give away. Actually, it all belongs to Him and for His use. And so it's just a real big mind shift. I personally want to get back to that sort of Puritan reformational worldview, that sort of our theology permeates all of our lives. We tend to just think, put things in boxes, don't we? And we don't allow our theology to drive through to all aspects of our lives, all aspects of everything that we do and are and have, all our kids at school, everything. We want to sort of protect these little bits and hold them back. But what's relevant about the Puritans, it's just so logical, isn't it? And it just permeates all aspects of their lives. And it's so enriching, and I love that, you know, Dane Altman really gets stuck into the Puritans and in his Gentle and Lowly book, and it's just bringing out the old gold, isn't it, from these dead guys, and rediscovering it.
And again, I think particularly in your first book, heavily focused on gospel. Second book again, but like you say, talk about the Trinity, and again that seeing Jesus as our riches is, I think, where most of us feel, don't we? You mentioned in the first book about Him being an insurance policy for many of us. He brings us comfort in the face of death, and then finance brings us comfort and insurance while we're alive. So it's like we're trusting in money and possessions to keep us safe in this world, and trusting in Jesus for the next. But we should be seeing Jesus as our prize, both now and for eternity, shouldn't we? So explain a little bit about how we can better teach the gospel to help our churches understand generosity and risk taking better.
Just on that question. I'm just, what comes to my mind at the minute is John Stott used to say that the pew won't rise above the pulpit. And I think I think there's a lot. I mean, we talk about it here, the sort of unspoken curriculum. People watch us, don't they? Our congregations watch us. And I think pastors, particularly preachers, teachers, but elders as well, church leaders, need to live out that radical truth in front of their congregations. Because I think it's being preached, okay, not everywhere, but there's enough good guys around preaching well, preaching to their churches every week. Like I don't think it's something that's not being preached, but I think it's got to be caught. And again, this could sound judgmental, and I'm making like sweeping general judgment, but I'm not. And maybe I'm speaking to myself as well, that maybe I haven't lived out that radical theology, that Reformation theology, enough in my life. That's why, I mean, I was convicted with the second book, that, you know, the generosity book. That convicted me. I mean, I was writing it and going, oh, that stings, you know, that, what does that mean? If that's right, then what does that mean for how I live? And what does that mean about how I view my money and how I, and the decisions I make about my kids and all the rest of it? And that's why I think we need to live out what we're preaching. We need to, and not just that, but follow it through. What does that mean? If this is right, what I'm preaching, what does that mean for my life and how I treat my congregation, my flock? Would I die for them? Would I suffer for them? Follow that through to its conclusion and live it out. That's radical. That's radical Christianity. And I think the flock will follow. I think the congregation will follow them, you know, they're modeling, you're modeling life to them. I think a lot of time our congregations are reflections of our leadership. Not always. I mean, I know there's stuff that goes on, church is messy and all the rest of it, but I do think if church leaders, and I speak to myself as well, being on leadership team at my church, if we start really living out that radical truth, what that could do, what that could mean for my congregation, for our flock, and then more broadly across our community, and we can't just be, we need to preach the gospel, but we need to live out. And I'm not talking about social justice or good works, even. I'm talking about living out the Bible, living out the gospel, living out what we're preaching. Just being, I think it's integrity. I think it's an honesty thing. It's a godly, holy life. My friend Dustin Bench, he's talking about at the moment. He talks a lot about walking worthy. I think it's walking worthy of our calling, walking worthy of living up to what we're saying and what we're preaching and what we're saying we're about. And we often fail. We often disappoint our churches. Is that too harsh?
No. For me, totally convicted. So when I was saved, I was an addict. I had nothing. I'd just come out of another failed relationship. I wasn't living on the streets, but I didn't have I moved back in with my mother. I was homeless. I was £40,000 worth in debt, and I got saved, and Jesus was everything to me. And I stepped out in faith so many times, or so I thought. It's only now that I have other things that I realised I didn't have anything to risk when I was saved, because I didn't have any. All I had was Jesus. And now the idols that have come up with my children and my wife, I've got a home, I've got a salary. I've just realised that for the last 3 years, I've never had to worry about my salary, but that throughout ministry for the 10 years prior, I was living month by month. And I've just seen how my decisions have become more cautious the more I've been blessed with, practically, and having being wise for your wife and children isn't a bad thing, and we should do that. We should be good stewards. But I've gone beyond being wise, and I've become frightened and again guilty of seeing material comfort as my security on earth and Jesus as my security in heaven. And again, just being convicted of having to get back to that place where I trust Jesus with my wife, my home, my finances, because as we saw with COVID, things can just change like that, can't we? So yeah, I totally agree. I don't think you're harsh, probably quite gentle, to be honest. The reality is we're all idolaters, aren't we? And when I was first reading these books, I was thinking, these are just obvious books. What's the point in writing them? We should all know that. And the fact that we all know it, but none of us are living it, shows why we need books like this to convict us. Because even if I'm preaching these messages, like you say, until we preach them to ourselves as leaders and we start living the message that we're preaching, people aren't going to follow either. Or very few will. They look to us to set that example.
Yeah, people can spot a fake, can't they? You know.
Well, you know Mess McConnell, don't you? I remember one of my daughters was really ill, and I remember ringing him in tears, thinking, "How can I preach on Sunday?" And he says, "You need to be careful because everything you've preached over the last 5 years, people will see how much you believe in that on Sunday when you turn up, knowing and." And when we're faced with trials, that's when people see, are we just getting up, giving a lecture, or are we sharing something that our lives are built upon, isn't it? And I'm just convicted on that often. Yeah, although I know these things are true, I don't put my feet, stand on them at all times. So, yeah, again, I think for me, what I've realised is the more we're blessed, we can become more reliant on the blessings of God than him himself.
Mm. But definitely.
The book goes on and it talks about generosity. And another thing which convinces me is you talk about playing God and motives for giving. And we can convince ourselves that we're being generous when we're just giving ourselves a break. And it reminded me of a time of I gave a brand new washing machine away to a man who was a recovering drug addict. And then a week later, he sold it to buy drugs, and I was fuming. I was absolutely furious. But at the same time, I'm thinking, well, I give it to him. He could have smashed it with a sledgehammer. It was his to do. It wasn't mine. But again, it's just so unnatural. It's so natural to God, but so unnatural to us. So what would be some of your advice, and how do we get to the place where we can freely give without any conditions attached to it, without becoming paternalistic or expecting anything back in return?
Yeah, I think we've got to be careful of it being transactional behind, but it has the appearance of generosity. And you know, you see it sometimes. I think with some donors. And even like when, you know, like you said, I mean, I similar to you, before I got married, I didn't have anything really. And when I was a missionary, I didn't have anything. But once you start to get some wealth and some substance behind you, then the trapping's going to come to the end. And I'm sure the thought has gone through people's minds, but it's sort of passed along mine. And then you know, I kicked it out of my brain. But sort of, you know, if I give X amount to the church, you know, will people will see it and will think good of me or something like that? You think that's so easy, that sort of trap of look how much I'm giving. It's a sort of Pharisee, you know, standing out on the street corner showing his, you know, how much he's giving, so much, and yet you're not really giving much. Because your heart isn't right, your motives aren't right, and it's all about the motives, isn't it? It's all about what the purpose of your heart, and it's really, again, it's really going back to that overflowing nature of God, to be godly, to be godlike in how we love people, because of that we're fueled by love, by God's love, because of his great love and his great generosity overflowing. It's having that overflowing heart where we're just flowing out with love and with joy and generosity, but it's a happy generosity. It's not stingy, it's not two-faced, it's not transactional, but it's free. It's gracious and free and joyful, because of who we are in Christ, because we're receiving freely, because we're receiving cheerfully what the Lord is giving and keeps giving and keeps blessing. So it's checking our hearts. It's having the right motives. It's trying to spot the pitfalls, especially when you have more to give. I think it's sin, isn't it? But we're always trying to get something out, something back. We've got to fight that instinct to try to get something back for what we're doing, whether it's a good work, whether it's cutting a neighbor's hedge or something. But it sort of creeps in, that sort of, let's get something out of this. And that's it. We've got to kill that. We've got to fight against that motive to make something back, but to freely give without expecting anything. Like you said, giving your washing machine away without expecting anything in return, even if it's disappointing. It's not focusing on the fruit of what you're doing, expecting to receive back from that directly, but it's loving people. It's really about the commandments. It's loving God, loving others.
Again, just even more convicted as you speak. I'm thinking my main concern should have been for his spiritual walk and the fact that he fell back into addiction, but I was thinking I could have sold that for 250 quid and had a weekend away. So my concern wasn't that he was struggling. My concern was, I could have had a weekend in a log cabin somewhere. Yeah.
Sounds nice about now, doesn't it?
But again, that brings us into, you spoke about in the book that some of us struggle to receive. And I know that is a serious problem, but it's not always been the problem with me. I think the problem for me is sometimes I've been willing to change my principles to receive, and that temptation there when there's some organisations that if we had a stricter constitution we'd be able to apply for funding for, and do we change it, do we tighten things up? I mean, in principle, I agreed with these things that we would have been tightening, but the reason they weren't tight were for missional purposes in the first place, but like finances and funding and stipulations given by givers can really test the heart of the receiver as well. Do you have any advice on how to be a good receiver, and when is the best time? When would you know it's right to say no to something?
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I mean, I guess the main fundraiser in the union, That's a really important area for me, to keep checking my heart and my motives. And like you say, is it right to receive this gift? Where is it coming from? Is it given in the right way, as it were, or the right, helpful way to help the giver? And personally, I had a problem to receive. From people, I found it hard to receive. I maybe a working class thing where you've got, I don't know, pride or a chip on your shoulder or something. But I used to find it hard. But I think it's linked to our giving. I think it's linked to our theology of giving and being joyfully generous. I think there's a link there, being willing to receive gladly, but also openly generous and joyfully generous, and that's why I put it in. So for me, that was something I had to get right in my heart for that one, and to be able to receive joyfully, and it is a real blessing to receive a lovely gift from a friend, and receive it with a full heart, with an open heart, and to say thank you. This is awesome. Thank you so much. it's something liberating in it. And I think, I mean, as you were talking about when to say no, I love the story of George Muller. He would say no to people. He would sort of ask them all sorts of questions. Why are you giving this gift? What? And he would almost interrogate the giver. And in some cases, he said, people, no, you should keep this. You shouldn't give this to me. So that takes a lot of guts, I think, especially if you're hard up. If you're a ministry that's in need, or if personally if you're hard up and you need the money and you need whatever the gift is, to be able to say no, you need to hold on to that with integrity. That takes courage. That's risk taking, isn't it? That takes courage and boldness and a dependence on God, that if this isn't right, I need to say no, and the Lord will provide from somewhere else. Again, it takes us back to what's our view of God. Is God sovereign? Can he provide for my needs or not? And if that definitely isn't right, to take, I don't know, where it's come from, a bad source, that it's maybe given in the right sort of way, but you just can't receive the money, then we need to have integrity and say, sorry, I can't take this. Yeah, that takes a lot of, I think that takes a lot of guts but a belief that the Lord will provide. He's sovereign. He's looking out for us, and I need to lean on him and be able to say, to stand on my convictions on it. But yeah, I love that. I think I talk about it in the book, but that's a great story. And I think it was he had a genuine pastoral care for people. There was one lady that I wrote about that was so desperately poor, like unbelievably poor for all of her life. And she worked hard and she came into some money, and he tried to talk her out of giving, I think. He tried to have her hold on to it and just, you know, you need this, you know, you need to look after yourself. But after talking to her, he had to take the money because she was giving with the right heart, with absolute belief that the Lord would keep providing for her. And she genuinely was compelled to give to support Muller and his ministry and, you know, the orphanage. So yeah, that was cool to see some of these stories and the integrity, raising money, fundraising and receiving money from your company. We shouldn't be shy about it. It shouldn't be a dirty thing or a sort of something that we don't want to talk about, you know. I just think that's the area that you want to shine a light on, and you want to, not probe, but you want to interrogate and are we doing things right? Are we doing things well? Are you giving in the right way? Let's talk about your generosity. It's really a litmus test of our hearts. How we're giving, what we're giving to, why we're giving, and you know, are we sacrificially giving as well? It does say a lot about our hearts and our view of God.
And again, I think that's what I love about both the books, is that the gospel is clear within that. Again, you talk about the Trinitarianism within that as well. So there's like deep theology in there, but it is it's written in such a way that it's accessible, but also it's not technical. It's written in the way that reminds us that this is all about Jesus. We don't just reflect Jesus, but we reflect the Father, the Son, and the Spirit in our giving and in our risk taking again. So for me, that's probably been the most encouraging, although it points us, it convicts us. I think it kind of gives us a cuddle as well and reassures us that even though we've got it wrong, that we have all that we need to put it right through God. And I could talk, we could do another full session just on what you talk about within the Trinity, what you talk about God being overflowing, or about the gospel within the first one. But I'm aware time's coming to end, so I just want to share a little bit about us. We are part of a small network of churches. We're called Meadows Ministries, and we are very small churches. We are slow growth. Each church is needs a high staff rate compared to the membership. So we employ 6 people. The membership's only 12. but the work is constant evangelism and getting out there into the community. Mm. But we're seen as high risk, low yield investment, and many funders are put off from supporting us. We might get $3,000 here and there, where other bigger agencies will get millions of pounds each year.
Yeah.
Because they're seen as a good investment. So my suggestion for you is you could make this into a trilogy. You could, your third book could be called Revolutionary Giving, Risk Taking and Generosity. <Hey. laughs>
There we go.
So how about that one?
Right.
How can we encourage donors to give according to need, regardless of the risks?
Yeah, absolutely. You're singing my tune, man. I see it a lot. And actually, that's what people have said about Union, to be honest. You know, oh, you're too, what do they say? Like, you're too new, because of the thing, it's a new thing, even though it's been going a while, you know, in its other form. You're too new with unproven track record, you're too risky, you know, and it's people, yeah, it's, and again, that's really annoying. Because like you think those are the ministries that actually need the money. You know, they're the ones that need help, and you everybody wants to give to the big established ministries that are sort of proven track record, and it's safe, it's sort of safe, right? It's very annoying. It resonates, and I think it comes from, especially like foundations and trusts, a lot of them are run by accountants, and then you've got people that are like business people and investors, and they talk about kingdom return. They want to see, well, what's going to happen? You know, they want results. It's a very American mindset as well, I think, that sort of kingdom return, that sort of, I want to see tangible, how many people are going to be saved, all that sort of stuff. I think, well, we're in a hard context, and it's going to take time, and we're not going to see like an immediate, you know, 20 people got saved last week sort of thing. Yeah, it's annoying. It's worldly, I think. And it's not, again, it's not in that sort of radical, you know, cheerful generosity that we're seeing, that we see in the Bible, and we see it's a worldly construct. And so, yeah, I'd like to fight against that as well. Sign me up. Yeah, I'll bang that drum.
Brilliant. Awesome. Joel, thanks very much for your time. You've been extremely generous with your time, and you've took a massive risk coming on this podcast.
Oh, really? Oh, no.
It's all like a familiar. No, seriously, I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate your books as well. And
That's really encouraging to hear. Thank you.
I'll have a couple of links to both your books and where they can purchase them from, as well as to Union Theology. I'm sure that 2 or 3 of my 5 listeners will be interested in buying these books. And I'm going to offer a couple of ways a free gift as well. So if we get a few more subscribers to the channels and to our Twitter account, I'll do a prize draw. So, yeah, hopefully we will be encouraged as leaders, and our congregations will follow suit in risking more for Jesus and sharing the good gift that he's given to us. But Joel, thanks very much for joining me on the In Context podcast.
Thank you so much. God bless you.